I was thinking this morning that most people, most Americans, have very little interest in the past. They're told their whole lives that the past is irrelevant. What's important is the future. And you've probably heard that kind of famous statement by David McCulloch, historian David McCulloch, who said, trying to plan for the future without considering the past is like trying to plant cut flowers. And indeed, that is the case. Without understanding the past, we can't understand the present or the future. But I also thought in terms of if God's providences are so numerous and there are so many billions of things that God is working together to accomplish his will, why do we even bother to study history? I mean, we have to pick and choose, sometimes in a very paltry fashion, how we are the facts that find out what the facts are and then interpret them based on our presuppositions. Why bother since it's all foreordained by God? And there are so many millions and millions of strands to understand. Why do we take the time to do it? And I'd like to turn our attention to a couple passages of Scripture. One is in 2 Kings chapter 6. Once when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servant, saying, such and such a place shall be my camp. But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there. And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him. Thus he used to warn him, so that he saved himself, and that more than once or twice. And the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing. And he called his servants and said to them, will you not show me who of us is the king of Israel? And one of his servants said, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha the prophet who is in Israel tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. And he said, go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him. It was told him, behold, he is at Dothan. You didn't know that Elisha lived in Alabama. So he sent there horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, alas, my master, what shall we do? He said, do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And the Bible doesn't tell us what the servant said, but it was probably, if he responded, it was something like, there isn't anybody with us. And Elisha prayed and said, O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see. So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. When the Syrians came down against him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, please strike the people with blindness. So he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. And Elisha said to them, this is not the way, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek. And he led them to Samaria, the whole Syrian army, of course, to the feet of the Israelite army. As soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, O Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see. So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw. And behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. As soon as the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, my father, shall I strike them down? He answered, you shall not strike them down. Well, every once in a while in the scripture, God pulls back the curtain to show us what is actually taking place, to show us what his providence is accomplishing and the means that he's using, in some cases, supernatural means, to accomplish his will. It happens in the book of Job, does it not, where the curtain is pulled back for us to see in the counsels of heaven what God is doing and saying about his servant Job. And then we read the book of Job, and we know what's happening because God has given us a glimpse into his will and into the providences that he's using to bring about his desired result in the life of Job and Job's friends and Job's family, etc. And I thought about the Psalms and the many Psalms that tell us about God's mighty acts and what we are to do in regards to them. Psalm 78. Give ear, O my people, to my teaching. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings from of old, things that we have heard and known that our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children and tell to the coming generation the glorious deeds of the Lord and his might and the wonders that he has done. And we know that God commanded the fathers of Israel to rehearse to their children every year and to their grandchildren the mighty deeds that God has done. We are commanded by God to study history and to see his hand and his hand of providence. And we use the scriptures as a template where we see from time to time God showing us that he is controlling things. He is using angels and powers and flaming chariots and all sorts of things to further his will. And while we don't see those things ourselves, we know that God is working and that he's commanded us to rehearse these things to our children and to our children's children. And so we are commanded to learn the mighty acts of God, and that includes all the mighty acts of God, and that includes our own history. And I was going to read some passages about our individual history as people, as God's people, and how he has set his love upon us as individuals and families and sometimes as cultures and brought about his purposes in a great and mighty way as he always does. Well, this morning I want to address a very interesting subject to me, and that is a particular friendship in American history that had a really huge impact on the founding of the United States. And it's interesting because it's a story of a friendship. And we don't often have in our lifetime a lot of close friendships, at least it's not been my experience. And most people I talk to only have a few inner circle of close friends that they may have accumulated over the years. There may be somebody from your high school years. There may be a couple people from your college years. Hopefully, husbands and wives, your wife or your husband is that close, intimate kind of friend. But here we're talking about outside of the family circle, close friendships. And sometimes God has used those kinds of friendships in history to turn history in the direction he wants it to go. And we have just such a friendship in the history of the United States. And I want to survey that just a little bit here in the time we have this morning. Few people develop close friendships. Some never do. Close friendship is one in which you can implicitly trust the other person. You can be yourself. You have common interests. You have shared experiences oftentimes and beliefs that bind you together. And your personality somehow meshes well with the other person. There have been friendships in the past that have made profound impact on the world. We see it even in the scriptures. David and Jonathan is the one that probably first comes to mind. A very close and intimate friendship that God used for his purposes in particular ways. In the run-up to secession of the southern states in 1861, the close personal ties between Alexander Stevens and Robert Toombs helped bring about the secession of the southern states, a new government, and the Constitution thereof. There is a book, in fact, detailing their close bond entitled The Friendship That Founded the Confederacy. And it is a fascinating work of two men from Georgia, two outstanding political men, one a devout Christian, the other somewhat of a rogue, yet they formed a very permanent bond, very permanent friendship. And that friendship, in the end, resulted in the solidification of the creation of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens and Robert Toombs. And I'm not here to talk about them. But just to alert you to the fact that there are times in history when close friendships result in great things. Andrew Jackson had what was called the kitchen cabinet. You know, when he became president, he appointed a cabinet, which was a political cabinet that was based on the importance of these men in the party. But he wanted his buddies from Tennessee. They're the ones that actually had wisdom. And so they came and they lived in Washington, and he would have this informal group of men that he met with to bounce off ideas and to share thoughts, etc. Men who understood him, men who were close friends from his past. And it's called the kitchen cabinet. And then, of course, there have been presidents of the United States who really didn't have any known close personal friends. Ulysses S. Grant was one. He had a wonderful wife, fortunately for him. Lyndon Baines Johnson, he only had acquaintances and enemies. There were he knew where every skeleton in every closet was, but he was an isolated character. Well, two men changed the world by founding the Republic of the United States. Two men so dissimilar in so many ways, but so alike in their passion for liberty, forged a friendship that endured to their deathbeds. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson are separately well known as founding fathers of the United States, but few people are aware of their personal friendship, the special bond that was forged in the heat of conflict in which failure might be rewarded on the gallows. George Washington was so reserved and in many ways so self-contained, even more than Southern gentlemen of that age often were, he likely had no male friends of that caliber. George Washington was a singular individual, perhaps no close friends his entire life. Alexander Hamilton, Patrick Henry, and John Hancock so specialized in making enemies, they brought it to an art form, but few of them had any intimate friends. Well, how do we know so much about Adams and Jefferson? Beyond the sparse public records of the Second Continental Congress or the occasional musings in a delegate's journal. Prior to the 20th century, interpersonal communication over distances relied solely on letter writing. The generation that founded the American Republic wrote a lot. And also, fortunately, most of them were wealthy men, and they could afford to buy paper, which was expensive, paper and ink. It is estimated that George Washington wrote or dictated and signed over 22,000 pieces of correspondence during the War for Independence. Think about that. 22,000 letters, as it were. He didn't write all of them himself. He dictated some of them. But he signed over 22,000 communiques. And his signature is still worth thousands and thousands of dollars. But who could have written more than George Washington? He had to communicate with, when he wanted to communicate with Congress, he had to send him a letter by courier. If he wanted to talk with his wife, he had to write a letter. And he was constantly writing during the war. In fact, one of the major criteria to serve on George Washington's staff was being a good penman, as he called it. You know, when people interviewed to be on his staff, first question, can you write well? Because they're going to be taking his dictation. They're going to be writing his letters for him. They're going to be sending out all the myriad dispatches that have to be written in the course of a war. Everything from battlefield orders to letters to Congress. Some public men still kept journals, especially New Englanders, and a few of those have survived. Paper and ink were expensive. Much of the American population was on the move to the frontier and didn't have time or extra money or a reason to correspond. So the writing of letters in itself tends to be a province of the wealthy who had time and resources to occasionally devote to the pastime of journal entries or private letters. A number of founders self-consciously understood they were part of a monumental undertaking that could change history, and they put a great deal in writing. The advantage we have with Adams and Jefferson is that their friendship in the founding era endured into the early Republic and all the way to their deaths in 1826. In fact, you probably realize by now that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, these close best friends, both died on the same day in 1826, and that day was the 4th of July, one of the more interesting providences of American history. When they passed, only one signer of the Declaration of Independence was still alive. Jefferson and Adams were the last, but for John, old John Carroll of Carrollton in Maryland. In fact, Carrollton lived into his 90s, sitting on his front porch, rocking in his rocking chair, while tourists came and looked at him. He was the last signer. He was still alive. He was in his 90s. It was the 1830s or 1840s. And people would come and just walk along the street and look up on the porch and point, there's John Carroll of Carrollton. He signed the Declaration of Independence. But before him, Adams and Jefferson were the last two. Over a period of 38 years, Adams wrote 189 letters to Jefferson, and Jefferson wrote 140 letters to Adams. Correspondence between Abigail Adams, John's wife, and Thomas Jefferson adds another 51 letters. The papers of Thomas Jefferson run to 50 volumes so far, and those of John Adams, 50 volumes so far. Just the things that they wrote or that were relevant to their lives, but mostly things that they wrote. 50 volumes, they're hefty. But amidst all of that is this correspondence between Adams and Jefferson, and the letters are brilliant and interesting and give us insight into the life and character of these two men. Now, there was a period of estrangement in their lives in which they did not write each other for about 10 years. It was a political estrangement, and I'll mention it later. The senior of the two men, John Adams, was the subject of a best-selling biography in 2001 by David McCulloch, book I recommend to you, and an award-winning HBO miniseries in 2008, about the only family-friendly thing HBO's ever come up with. In some ways, those two productions have rehabilitated and humanized John Adams in ways that previous biographies have not. Born of typical Massachusetts farmers, Adams' heritage lay deep in the Puritan soil of New England. His immigrant forebears coming in the Great Puritan Migration in 1638, his modest law practice in Boston received a boost of notoriety in 1770 when he defended the British soldiers brought to trial for the so-called Boston Massacre. His incredible and principled defense won the acquittal of those men for murder and marked him as an upcoming personage, potentially quite useful to the king. Adams rejected royal preferment and put his extraordinarily logical mind and commitment to preserving American legal rights to the use of the cause of independence, the cause of Massachusetts liberty, or rebellion if you take the royalist view. Almost certainly he never would have met Thomas Jefferson had not Providence brought John Adams to Philadelphia as a delegate to the Second Continental Congress in 1775. Thomas Jefferson came into the world in a Virginia family of privilege and material wealth, a son of the planter Peter Jefferson, quite unlike, in many ways, John Adams. But John Adams was a small farmer. Thomas Jefferson was a big farmer. John Adams got his hands dirty. Thomas Jefferson's slaves got their hands dirty. They're very unalike in some ways, but they loved and appreciated the same things. Thomas Jefferson inherited 5,000 acres and a plantation from his father and added another 5,000 upon the death of his father-in-law. His more than 100 slaves kept the household self-sufficient, though Jefferson's improvident spending habits kept his personal estate in perpetual debt. So much so that when he died, his inheritors had to sell Monticello. And they never did pay all the debts that Thomas Jefferson had accrued over a lifetime. Short-sighted in some ways. Somebody came along and bought Monticello and eventually fixed it up and turned it back so that we can visit it. Elected to represent Virginia at the Second Continental Congress, this quiet and passive Jefferson came into immediate contact with the loquacious and opinionated New England firebrand, John Adams. There is no known public speech made by Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson didn't make speeches. He had a silver pen, however.
He knew how to write and put thoughts in order on paper. John Adams was a public man. He liked the give and take of a courtroom. He liked controversy, so much so that he stirred up more than his share. And he was talkative. They would be thrown together on the famous Committee of Five, along with Benjamin Franklin, Robert Livingston, and Roger Sherman, to fulfill the imperative document of independence made necessary by Richard Henry Lee's successful proposal to declare separation from the mother country. Adams later recounted the dialogue between him and Jefferson when the proposal was made for the Virginian to write the rough draft of the Declaration of Independence. When Jefferson remonstrated that Adams ought to be the writer, Adams replied, quote, "There are three reasons you should be the author. One, a Virginian ought to be seen as the head of this business. Two, I am obnoxious, suspected, and unpopular. And three, you can write 10 times better than I can." David McCulloch has pointed out that in all the voluminous record of the Congress, only one man wrote disparagingly of John Adams, and that was John Adams. He was already on 23 separate committees and was about to add three more in the coming weeks when he got put on the Committee of Five to write the Declaration. It was John Adams who proposed George Washington as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. And it was he who proposed Thomas Jefferson to write the Declaration of Independence. If that is all he accomplished in his long life, we would be overwhelmingly indebted to him for his wisdom and insight. Having made common cause for independence, the two unlikely colonial farmers became fast friends. And what a contrast. Neither had likely ever met anyone from the other section before they were thrown together in Congress, and an incongruous pair they made. Jefferson was only 33, the youngest Virginia delegate and 8 years younger than Adams. He was tall and angular, red-headed, a superb horseman, a good singer, a violin player, and a polymath he was interested in and would eventually be considered an authority on astronomy, horticulture, architecture, math, sciences, and the classics. He was soft-spoken. As I said, he gave no public addresses. He was diplomatic, spoke French, Italian, Spanish, and German, did not object publicly to those who disagreed with him, and was a peacemaker whenever possible. He sparkled in private conversation, but often left a bit of ambiguity in his arguments. He invented a plow based on mathematical principles and positively gloried in designing and redesigning buildings, both public and private. He attended the College of William and Mary and read law for 5 years with George Wythe, the greatest legal mind of his day. Jefferson spent money far beyond his means, never in his lifetime managing to get out of debt. He always, when he saw something he wanted, he just bought it, whether he had the money or not. And he told Adams one time, and they were discussing books, as both were avid readers, he said, "I cannot live without books." And I understand his sentiments. He had 6 children, only 4 of whom lived to maturity, and he suffered the agony of the loss of his wife at age 33, a grief he almost could not endure, and one that he never really got over. John Adams was short, stout, and bald. He was outspoken and blunt, sometimes to the point of rudeness. No one had to guess what he thought on a matter. He watched every penny and did not overspend on anything except books, which is no vice. He had a few close friends, but a very special relationship with his wife. They addressed each other as "my dearest friend." And the letters of John Adams and Abigail Adams have also been published, and they are a wonder to read. Talk about correspondence and love between a husband and wife. It's an absolutely remarkable relationship. And it is interesting. Everybody wants to claim Abigail, especially the feminists, because she was intelligent. She was self-educated. She put her foot down. She argued with her husband. She's not a proto-feminist. You read the letters of love and concern, and you might say, in the biblical sense, subjection, and the fact that she raised all of their children without him being there most of the time and doing so successfully.
John Adams attended Harvard. He had a deep appreciation for history, especially for the rock-ribbed conservatism and virtues of his own ancestors. Although deeply affected by Enlightenment humanism, his instincts were rooted in biblical ethics.
He was an opponent of slavery.
Enduring friendships are built on what people have in common. In the case of Adams and Jefferson, they both loved words, books, and serious scholarship. They both were steeped in the ancient inherited laws, and their love of liberty trumped everything else. They both were drawn to noble endeavors. They disdained indolence and laziness, and they hated wasting time. Both used the expression, "my country," and by it they meant Massachusetts and Virginia. The crisis of independence and the common cause of the war for independence brought them together and cemented a lifelong friendship. McCulloch describes Adams as the colossus of independence. Jefferson said, quote, "His power of thought and expression moved us from our seats." Their letters revealed that both of them had, quote, "a keen sense of perspective and a consciousness of great events in the making." They understood that they were making history, and that if they succeeded, they themselves would be talked about for generations to come. Having read the Continental philosophers, whose works were common property of 18th century intellectuals, they, quote, "put theory into practice in government, then reassess theory in the light of their own experiments." Perhaps the best illustration of that principle was the Constitutional Convention that changed the Articles of Confederation so dramatically. Though neither man was present for that revolution, they hoped that the new government would perpetuate Republican virtues and maintain balanced government. Neither man ever wavered in affirming the wisdom of their decision of 1776, but also never believed their achievements could be assured without what they called eternal vigilance. They supported the Constitution, but took differing views on aspects of its application. These two founders had very dissimilar temperaments, but found that they could work together in a cause so much larger than themselves. When it came to marriage, when it comes to marriage, the only times opposite attract is in magnets. The more two people have in common, the more successful the marriage is likely to be. When it comes to the type of close bond formed by men, like the subject of this lecture, their differences were bound to eventually bring about strains and even temporary separation, as it did. One contemporary described Adams as a man with a heart formed for friendship and susceptible to its finest feelings. He had a keen sense of humor and an eye for the ridiculous and incongruous, and a willingness to poke fun at himself. Jefferson was a man of tremendous reserve. With no ambition, no heart for personal diatribe, and a desire to live in harmony. Now, you would think these two men would not naturally be attracted to one another, but they were. He kept no diary, as Adams did, and was reluctant to reveal his heart on any matter in most correspondence, except with Adams. Jefferson deferred to his elder friend, but took personally the diatribes against him from the Adams camp in the election seasons of 1896, and especially 1800. Both men served in George Washington's cabinet and were negatively affected by the polarizing shenanigans of Alexander Hamilton. I think the root disagreements that Adams and Jefferson endured stemmed from their differing views of the basic nature of man. Adams had a much more jaundiced view of the innate depravity of mankind. While he rejected the orthodox Calvinism of his predecessors, Adams distrusted the heart of man and was willing to support a stronger role of civil authority in the lives of Americans. Jefferson took a more idealistic view of man, especially those who lived by the soil and toil of their hands. His trust in the wisdom of the farmer trumped whatever distrust he suspected lurked in the heart of men in general. The difference in the two have been expressed this way. John Adams was the skeptical realist, and Thomas Jefferson was the practical idealist. A major difference between them became evident in their views of the French Revolution. Jefferson supported it as the flowering of liberty and the end of monarchy. Adams viewed it as a demonstration of bloody rejection of history and installation of mob rule.
Jefferson publicly extolled the atheist Tom Paine's essay on the rights of man. Adams deplored it. Both men had deeply flawed theology, heavily tainted with the humanist touch, touching faith in, quote, scientific criticism and rejection of divine revelation. Both of them quoted scripture and believed in God, but both rejected Trinitarian theology, which would put them mighty close to Arianism in their beliefs. Joel McDermott of the American Vision wrote an essay a couple weeks ago, well, right on Christmas time, with the sensitive title of Why Santa Claus Would Punch John Adams in the Face. And what it was a little brief analysis of Adams's anti-Trinitarian theology compared with the original Saint Nicholas and his accomplishments. So Adams was not, he was not the orthodox Christian that we would like him to be. And certainly John Adams was not either. And as I said earlier, they were put on the Committee of Five. They were thrown together. That's where they got to know one another pretty well. But actually, their friendship matured, and a lot of the letters between them in the early years took place when both men were sent by Congress to France. Adams himself, while there, left for Holland as well, and they corresponded while they were there. For Adams, quote, McCulloch says, it was a role of the kind he most loved, I can't read my own handwriting either. Setting something, his own, against the odds, setting his own fortune against the odds in the service of the greatest of causes. He believed that the fate of the revolution hung in the balance whenever he was assigned to go accomplish something. He believed that he had to accomplish it, or the work of the War of Independence would fail. In September of 1783, they were in Paris, and the Treaty of Paris was being signed. It was signed by Adams, Benjamin Franklin, and John Jay. It was 9 years at the end of the War for Independence. It was 9 years since the First Continental Congress, 8 years since Lexington and Concord, 7 since the Declaration of Independence, and 3 years since Adams had left home as the potential peacemaker. And so he was gone for 3 years from his beloved Abigail, and they corresponded during that time. She scolded him over and over for not writing frequently, but letters took a long time to cross the Atlantic, and if the ship was sunk or captured, those letters were lost. But in Paris, together, we find the flourishing of a friendship that under normal circumstances at home would not likely have happened in the same way. Their bonds grew exceptionally strong. And there's a lesson here for us that from time to time, God in his providence puts us together with somebody that we feel a natural kinship to. And for Christians, part of that is the bonds of Christ. But some people we just naturally have an affinity for and develop a close friendship quickly. And it's those times that God brings a friend into our lives for particular purposes, and we need to make the most of those opportunities, keeping in mind that God is directing the affairs of our lives and moving us in particular directions and putting us in contact with particular people. And it might even just be for a short time. I have people that I'm still close friends with, and I was only with them a very short time, a year or 2 years, yet we're still very close friends. So God does that every once in a while. That's what happened with Jefferson and Adams in Paris. Though they'd served on committees and were good friends, when they were thrown together, sort of in the crucible of the diplomatic end of the American War for Independence, their friendship flourished.
They dined with each other constantly. Jefferson welcomed John Quincy Adams into his own personal inner circle. Now, John Quincy Adams was just a young boy, and John took him with him to Europe. John Adams had great goals for his son, John Quincy. He recognized in him a superior intelligence. He was a young man who read greatly. He was brilliant. In fact, they sent him, while he was in Europe with his dad, at the age of 11, he was sent as the assistant ambassador to the court of in St. Petersburg, Russia, because he spoke French. And the American ambassador, in the great foresight of the Congress, sent an ambassador that spoke no Russian to Russia, and the common language was French. And so young John Quincy off to Russia to translate for the ambassador of the United States in Russia. But Thomas Jefferson made little John Quincy part of his own inner circle. You can imagine what he learned. In fact, eventually John Quincy Adams is going to become president of the United States, perhaps the single most intelligent, well-educated, experienced man that ever served in that office. Not the most successful, necessarily, but perhaps the most brilliant after Jefferson himself. Sons learn from good men. And being thrown together with adults who can really contribute and build into their lives. And that was the case in the case of John Quincy Adams. His father recognized, here's a man that can really help my son and can build into his life things that nobody else can. And so he allowed him to do that. As I said, they dined at Mr. John Quincy kept a diary, and he said one night, dined at Mr. Jefferson's. Spent an evening with Mr. Jefferson, whom I love to be with. His diary is constantly mentioning the time he spent with Thomas Jefferson. Arthur Lee wrote a letter to Adams, and Arthur Lee was an enemy of Thomas Jefferson. And he said, you need to beware of Thomas Jefferson's supposed genius. He's mediocre. He's vain. He's greedy. And he warned him, never confide in Thomas Jefferson. And Adams wrote back to Lee, my new partner is an old friend whose character I studied 10 years ago and which I do not perceive to be altered. I am very happy with him. He stood up, even in a private letter, he stood up against calumny, against his friend. There's a lesson for us. Even though to Arthur Lee, Thomas Jefferson was vain and sneaky, and he might have been. But Adams said, I've known him for 10 years, and he's never done me wrong. He's a man of character that I can trust, and I'm very happy to be with him. Since they had been together, Thomas Jefferson had had two children die, and his wife in 1782 at the age of 33. So he was a widower with three young children. He had spent time writing and revising the laws for Virginia. He had been the governor of Virginia. He had entertained British POWs, officers, incarcerated in Charlottesville. He had been forced to flee when Benedict Arnold brought a loyalist British army against the House of Burgesses. It cost him his reputation. He had shattered his wrist in a fall from a horse. All of these things had happened since he had last seen John Adams, and now they were thrown together in Paris. And writing of Adams to someone who had written a letter to ask him about John Adams, and this was early on in their relationship in Paris, Jefferson writes this, John Adams, he hates Franklin. He hates Jay. So those are the other two ambassadors to France. He hates the French, but he also hates the English. John is vain and tasteless, but honest. He's a man of integrity and sound, has a sound head on substantial points. His prejudices will be balanced out, and he'll be a good ambassador. So he understood his friend. He knew his weaknesses and his strengths. And his assessment was, he's perfect for the job he's been given. Thomas Jefferson, of course, was the ultimate shopper and clothes horse in Paris. He never denied himself something he wanted. The French banks stopped loaning money. And so off Adams went to get loans from the Dutch. If you think the French are hard to borrow money from, the Dutch set new standards for being tight-fisted and not allowing their thalers to get into the hands of anybody that might be a risk. And so Adams had his work cut out for him. In the end, the burghers did give him the money. In principle, Thomas Jefferson abhorred debt and cities. He talked about it all the time, how much he hated debt and hated cities. Yet, he spent most of his life in cities and in debt. The booksellers of Paris found they had a patron like no other. He bought books every day. He bought 2,000 books in Paris for himself and for George Washington and for Franklin and for Madison, with whom he corresponded, was his best friend. He bought 6 paintings, 7 busts, and he commissioned Houdon to make a statue of George Washington. He was devoted to playing chess, but he got beat badly every time. And he did not speak French as well as Adams did, and was more outspoken, believe it or not, against the loose morals of French women than ever Adams was. Well, the only success Thomas Jefferson ever had in France was signing a treaty with Prussia, which was bordered on irrelevant. As ambassador to the court of St. James, John Adams went to England, and they exchanged 28 letters between Adams in England and Jefferson in France, entirely trusting in each other. They negotiated with the Tripolitan pirates, and finally Thomas Jefferson came over to London to visit with John Adams, and here they embarked on their famous garden tour. Now, that doesn't mean that they walked through the posies behind the house. In England, the gardens were a serious, serious thing of hundreds of acres of beautifully landscaped property. It's the only time they spent off on their own together in their lifetime, free of work and responsibility. At heart, both were farmers. Both were countrymen. And they were actually in the greatest country gardens in the world. They love soil, tillage, climate. They like to talk about improvements. These were not little flower gardens, but elaborate parks, and they were made by famous landscape gardeners. They were full of waterfalls, architectural niceties, bridges, pagan temples, which were not to John Adams' liking. Not a word was recorded by either one of this trip. They went through 20 different places together and never discussed it publicly or in a letter. So we don't know what they just had a wonderful time as two American farmers on the loose in the land of their former enemy. As Vice President and Secretary of State, their friendships cooled in the 1790s. There were public controversies. As I said, Thomas Jefferson endorsed Paine's attack on Edmund Burke's criticism of the French Revolution and mentioned Adams as saying, "Political heresies have sprung up among us." By this time, he meant John Adams' writings. John Quincy Adams rose to defend his father, and he critiqued the rights of man and took Thomas Jefferson to task. And Jefferson responded, "It sounds like John Adams is a monarchist," which he wasn't. Well, the Adams-Jefferson feud lasted for a number of years, and they were perceived as arch rivals. And they were perceived as arch rivals by historians for many years. Adams was elected to the presidency in 1796. Thomas Jefferson was vice president. Jefferson had no reluctance to serve under Adams. In fact, he wrote, quote, "the warmest, friendliest, brotherly letter he ever wrote." But Madison, James Madison, intercepted it and said, "Friendships and politics should not mix," and never delivered it. And I don't have time to go into the election and all of that. I wanted to read to you some excerpts from some of the letters. They finally, through the intermediary Benjamin Rush, who was also a signer of the Declaration of Independence, they were finally reconciled in 1811. And the first, it's interesting how the reconciliation came about, is that a couple of Thomas Jefferson's nephews were going to travel to Massachusetts, and he gave them a letter of introduction to John Adams. And Adams met these young men and really admired them and let slip in a conversation that he really missed talking with Thomas Jefferson and corresponding with him. And the word got back through Benjamin Rush back to Thomas Jefferson that Adams would like to be friends again, and trying to reconcile the two. And eventually the reconciliation took place, and I won't read to you that particular letter, but let me just give you a flavor of of some of their correspondence. It's very interesting. They talked about just about everything. This was on the subject of prophecies. A curious thing. They wrote about everything. And if you thought that Henry Kissinger was the Antichrist, that isn't new. In 1812, there were prophets in America before they even invented dispensationalism. There were prophets who were declaring that Napoleon Bonaparte was the Antichrist and saying that the French Revolution, et cetera, et cetera. And these books were read by Jefferson and Adams with great hilarity. And then they commented on them to one another. The kinds of things that other men probably weren't talking about. But they were such voracious readers. They read everything. And Jefferson was interested in everything. So this letter from Adams back to Jefferson, after Jefferson mentioned these books of prophecy, says, "Although you and I are weary of politics, you may be surprised to find me make a transition to such a subject as prophecies. I find that Virginia produces prophets, as well as the Indiana Territory. There have been largely lately sent for me from Richmond two volumes, one written by Nimrod Hughes and the other by Christopher McPherson, both upon prophecies, and neither ill-written. He says, for though they are evidently cracked, they are not much more irrational than Dr. Towers, who wrote two ponderous volumes near 20 years ago to prove that the French Revolution was the commencement of the millennium." And so the conversation goes on like that in this letter. And he talks about the Indian prophets and about Tenskwatawa, who was the brother of Chief Tecumseh, and his prophecies about the extermination of the white man. He says, let me just pick up here. "The Reverend Mr. Faber, who has lately written a very elegant and learned volume to prove that Napoleon is Antichrist, nor than our worthy friend Mr. Joseph Wharton of Philadelphia, who is, in consequence of great reading and profound study, has long since settled his opinion that the city of London is or has to be the headquarters of Antichrist, nor than the prophet of the Wabash, Tenskwatawa, of whom I want to know more than I do, because I learned that the Indians, the sons of the forest, are as superstitious as any of the great learned men aforesaid, and as firm believers in witchcraft as all Europe and America were in the 17th century, and as frequently punish witches by splitting their skulls with the tomahawk after a solemn trial and adjudication by the sachems and warriors in council. The Crusades were commenced by the prophets in every age since. Whenever any great turmoil happens in the world, has produced fresh prophets. The continual refutation of all their prognostication by time and experience has no effect in extinguishing or dampening their ardor." So what he's saying is the prophets are all proven wrong all the time, the modern prophets, but experience and time and history have no effect on them. They continue to predict and predict and predict. It's kind of interesting. And they went back and forth a couple letters.
And then they had, on June 28th, 1813, a correspondence about religion. And there's a great deal of insight into the lives of, into the beliefs of these two men. And I'll just summarize by saying that both of them were men who, I don't know how we would say it, I guess admired the morality of the Bible. They admired the ethics of Christianity, yet at the same time rejected Trinitarian theology. And I don't think Adams necessarily rejected the miracles of the Bible. Certainly Jefferson did. And they had interesting correspondence back and forth about science and morals and the Christian faith and about all kinds of denominations. They both discuss Methodists and Presbyterians and deists, etc. And John Adams says, let's see, the general principles on which the fathers of achieved independence, referring to himself and the others, were the only principles in which that beautiful assembly of young gentlemen could unite, and these principles only could be intended by them in their address or by me in my answer. And what were these great principles? I answer, the general principles of Christianity, in which all the sects were united, and the general principles of English and American liberty, in which all those young men united, for which and which had united all parties in America, the majority sufficient to assert and maintain her independence. Now, I will avow that I then believed and now believe that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God, and that those principles of liberty are as unalterable as human nature and our terrestrial mundane system. I could therefore safely say, consistently with my with all my then and present information, that I believed that they would never make discoveries in contradiction to biblical principles. In favor of these general principles in physiology, religion, government, or psychology, religion and government, I could fill sheets of quotations from Frederick of Prussia, from Hume, Gibbon, Bolingbroke, Rousseau, and Voltaire, as well as Newton and Locke, not to mention thousands of divines and philosophers of inferior fame. I might have flattered myself that my sentiments were sufficiently known to have protected me against suspicion of narrow thoughts, contrasted sentiments, bigoted, enthusiastic, or superstitious principles, civil, political, philosophical, or ecclesiastical. And then he goes on. This letter's already too long. In my next, I will consider the terrorism of the day. Meantime, I am your friend always, John Adams. Now, there, I need to skip to the end. We started late, fortunately, so I don't feel too compelled, but I do want to jump to the end of the matter. That is the end of their lives and the end of their correspondence, from which they're not going to survive much longer. Jefferson's, let's see, Jefferson's last letter to Adams, and I'll read their last two letters to one another. Monticello, March 25th, 1826. I remember they're going to die on the 4th of July that year. Dear sir, it's from Jefferson. My grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, being on a visit to Boston, would think he had seen nothing were he to leave it without seeing you. Although I truly sympathize with you in the trouble these interruptions give, yet I must ask for him permission to pay to you his personal respects. Like other young people, he wishes to be able, in the winter nights of old age, to recount to those around him that he has heard and learnt of the heroic age preceding his birth, and which of the Argonauts, particularly, he was in time to have seen. It was the lot of our early years to witness nothing but the dull monotony of colonial subservience, and of our riper ones to breast the labors and perils of working out of it. Theirs are the halcyon calms succeeding the storm, which our argosy had to stoutly weather. Gratify his ambition, then, by receiving his best bow, and my solicitude for your health by enabling him to bring me a favorable account of it. Mine is but indifferent, but not so my friendship,
and respect for you, Thomas Jefferson. Adams replied on April the 17th, "My dear sir, your letter of March 25th has been a cordial to me, and the more consoling as it was brought by your grandsons, Mr. Randolph and Mr. Coolidge. Everybody connected with you is snatched up, so that I cannot get any of them to dine with me. They are always engaged. How happens it that you Virginians are all sons of Anak?" That is, giants. "We New Englanders are but pygmies by the side of Mr. Randolph. I was very much gratified with Mr. Randolph and his conversation. Your letter is one of the most beautiful and delightful I have ever received. Public affairs go on pretty much as usual, perpetual chicanery, and rather more personal abuse than there used to be. Messrs. Randolph and McDuffie have out-Heroded Herod. Mr. McDuffie seems to be swallowed up in chivalry. Such institutions ought not to be suffered in a Republican government. Our American chivalry is the worst in the world. It has no laws, no bounds, no definitions. It seems to be all a caprice. My love to all your family and best wishes for your health, John Adams." It was their last letter. On July 4th, Thomas Jefferson died at 1 o'clock p.m. At 4 o'clock, Adams speaks his last words. At least Thomas Jefferson survives. And he died at 6:20. John Adams' inscription was carved on a sarcophagus lid of Henry Adams, the first immigrant of the Adams family to come to Massachusetts in the Great Puritan Migration. John Adams had this inscribed on his great-great-grandfather's sarcophagus. In 1630, he arrived in 1638. He died around 1700. But John Adams wrote this on the sarcophagus of his great-grandfather: "This stone and several others have been placed in this yard by a great-great-grandson from a veneration of piety, humility, simplicity, prudence, frugality, industry, and perseverance of his ancestors, in hopes of recommending an affirmation of their virtues to their posterity." And that gives you a little insight into the mind of Jefferson and Adams, and I recommend to you the Adams-Jefferson letters, which are in print, where you can see in the providence of God how these two men were brought together, founded the Republic, and then maintained a friendship throughout most of the rest of their lives.